open up the public hearing on Senate for the Senate Committee on Business and Consumer Affairs and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2085. And John Brenneman and Lynn Fessler and Pat Schwab. Now we have all three of you folks come up. Lynn, do you want to start this off?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I would be glad to. And I'm hoping that Senator Yee might join us as well, but she hasn't arrived yet. She's a strong advocate of this bill, and she may pop in here.
Okay, well, that's good.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, some time ago, back in 1989, a fund was established by assessing park tenants who owned their own homes a $5 fee. That fund was created to help tenants have a loan fund to utilize for pre-development expenses, market studies, appraisals, earnest money agreements, that sort of thing, to test the feasibility of purchasing their park. And there she is.
Seems like I didn't interrupt you. Senator Yee, would you like to introduce yourself and make some comments? I know you have another committee meeting. You do have another committee meeting.
Yes, I do.
So if you'd please introduce yourself. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, for the record, I am State Senator May Yee, representing Senate District 19, consisting of portions of Lynn and Benton counties, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify on behalf of House Bill 2085 today. To give you a copy of my testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members, manufactured dwelling park or mobile home park tenants are subject to state rent increases. The rent increases enacted by owners of the park often occur more frequently than tenants feel is warranted, and the amount of the increases seems higher than necessary in their view. The tenant frustration with the rent increases sometimes causes tenants to think about collectively buying the park they live in. The 1989 legislative session created a loan fund for tenants who want to purchase their parks. The fund provides loans to tenant associations to use for pre-development expenses during a park purchase. Pre-development expenses include items like engineering studies, financial feasibility analysis, purchase options, appraisals, legal advice, and other expenses. The loan fund is not large enough to finance the entire park purchase price. Housing and Community Services Department has worked with over 30 tenant groups statewide to explore their purchase of the park where they live. No park has ever been purchased by the tenants to date. After an initial interest in park purchases, tenants have not found it feasible or attractive to purchase the parks for a variety of reasons. These reasons include the inability of the tenants to meet the bank lending requirements for a loan. The day-to-day park management responsibilities tenants must be responsible for, or the reluctance of some of the tenants to want to participate in the purchase. What has been a universal desire by the tenants, however, is the interest in having a not-for-profit entity purchase the park and operate a park at no profit with a tenant's interest in mind. House Bill 2085 allows this interest to be pursued. As allowed by the bill, a not-for-profit corporation selected by the tenants is allowed to use the pre-development loan fund to explore the feasibility of buying the park. the not-for-profit organization can borrow from the fund to pay for the necessary engineering studies, financial evaluations, and negotiate with the owner. The loan is repaid when the park is ultimately purchased. The repaid funds are then made available for the next park purchase group to use. When the not-for-profit organization buys the park, the tenants will achieve the rent stabilization they desire. Rents will only be increased as absolutely necessary. Tenants can also be representatives on the not-for-profit board of directors. Tenants will have their financial and management interests addressed without the responsibility of actual park ownership. I'm aware of a situation where this bill would be helpful. The bill would provide the opportunity for pre-development funds to be available for Lynn County affordable housing to explore the feasibility of purchasing the Twin Cedars Manufacturer Dwelling Park in Lebanon. All parties involved, the tenants, park owner, the nonprofit organization, and Department of Housing and Community Service are here to testify in support of this bill. I'm submitting here with an emergency clause to allow this bill to become effective upon passage so all the parties can go to work immediately. And I ask your favorable consideration of the amended House Bill 2085.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Yee, are you aware of funding sources that in the instance you listed were Lynn County Affordable Housing put out some money to buy the park?
Yes. They can work it out to make loans from banks or from other organizations that Department of Housing and Community Services recommend.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Senator. Appreciate you coming down and testifying. Thank you for getting the wheat bill taken care of back in Washington, D.C. I appreciate that.
If I may be excused, I'm going to my committee.
Okay.
But you can call me in room F anytime you want to.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Then, start again.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you, and committee members. And Senator Yee has explained the whole purpose of the bill quite well and thoroughly. After this initial hearing, we did meet with both the park owner's representative as well as some of the tenant representatives. There were some modifications. You see them included in the Ann Gross version of the bill, and I think it's fairly self-explanatory. We're very anxious to get and encourage the emergency clause that Senator Yee reflected because we are quite anxious to get this bill implemented and start testing the feasibility of some purchases.
Okay. Thank you. Pat?
Yes.
Could you pull the microphone
over? For the record, my name is Pat Schwartz. I represent Manufactured Homeowners of Oregon. We support this bill as a way to give low-income manufactured home park residents, nonprofit residents, an opportunity to buy their parks. This is the only means by which these residents can get control over what happens in their plight to afford living independently in the home that they own. We certainly hope that you will give this some favorable consideration and hopefully get it passed out of the Senate and into the House. Thank you.
Thank you. John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm John Brenneman. For the record, I represent the Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. Our members manage and own parks in, that we're talking about here. Since the House amended 2085 to alleviate a couple of our concerns, we're okay now and support the bill and would urge you to adopt it.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Charles Crawford and Jerry Drexter? Yeah, that's it. Come on up. And Margaret, who's it? Mariana? Mariana Bonebolt? Excuse me for my Mariana, are you here? Is it, is Mariana right? Charles Crawford? Oh, okay.
Thank you very much.
All right. And Deanna. Is it Deanne or Deanne?
Diane.
It's like a Deanna to me. Is that, is it Deanna? Okay. Welcome. And, sir, do you want to start? Is it Jerry? Is it Jerry?
Jerry Dirksen, yes. My name is Jerry Dirksen. I'm the president and broker for Dirksen Associates Real Estate. We're a Corvallis real estate firm involved in mobile home park sales and management. We're also the, myself and one of my co-owners is here today. We own the park in the Twin Cedars Mobile Home Park in Lebanon. And this, the reason that we're in support of the bill is the, I think there's some advantages, certainly a lot of advantages for the tenants to purchase the park if they're capable of doing so. The by utilizing the affordable or the nonprofit organizations, I think they could put some of these together, whereas in the past they haven't been able to. The bill basically, it addresses affordable housing, it addresses senior citizens. In our case, the park is a 55 and over senior citizen park, 100%. It addresses low income, fixed income, and it's very much a form of rent control for the folks who work with the nonprofit, and we're very much in support of it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Thornfold. I am a senior. I am a resident of the Manufactured Home Park. I'm also a member of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, and affordable housing is one of our priority concerns. We have endorsed this bill and urge you to pass it out. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
My name is Diana Satanovich, and I'm the director of Linn County Affordable Housing. We serve all of Linn County outside of the city of Albany, and our mission is to develop and maintain quality affordable housing for low and moderate income persons in that service area. And we have to date, we have completed three projects, most all of them multifamily, one for seniors, and we are in the process of acquiring and rehabbing, have acquired and will rehab a fourth project. We are interested and do support this bill because our mission, once again, is to develop and maintain quality, affordable housing for people, and we see this as an opportunity to do so. Working with the residents, we always have resident representation and participation in our organization, working with the residents to achieve their goals, but maintaining oversight and taking the burden and the fiscal responsibility in hand so that it will be well maintained for the long run. So I urge you to support this bill.
Thank you. Senator Yee and Senator Blair asked a question about it. This is your group that's going to provide the funding, or is this a different group?
Well, we would do the pre-development work and hire to provide the appraisal and the feasibility, and we would go after the financing through the State Housing Department or a like entity, perhaps NOAA, the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing, a consortium of 20-some banks that does provide low interest loans to us on a regular basis to acquire or to construct affordable housing. So the resources are available. I think the question is to find an entity that can do it well, keep it maintained for the long run, and allow the residents to manage from their point of view according to what their needs and their goals are. All of our properties involve a form of social support, whereby residents and our organization work together to find out what is needed, and we do a resource referral or an on-site social service activity. Well, this particular group of people is very well organized already. They do a good job of maintaining their park. It's beautifully managed. I think our job would be to find the financing to keep it affordable for the next 30 plus years.
Okay, I guess I have a
one page thing came that's up, produced by the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. And one of the things that they're talking about is one of the problems that causes the conflict, that their conflict, that their spaces to site homes are limited. Now, is that, do you feel that that's a real key thing throughout this area, or do you have any response to that?
It's my understanding that the vacancy rate for mobile home parks virtually in the entire state is almost zero. So when you say limited, I would say that's an understatement.
Mm-hmm.
Our parks, we manage collectively, I think, somewhere around 600 and some units, and of those, I'm not sure we have a single vacancy at this point. We may have one or two in Klamath Falls, I'm not sure, but it's almost zero. And even when the units do come up for sale, the rent continues to be paid regardless, so the unit normally doesn't move out even if the people vacate or if a lender picks it up for default or whatever, so the vacancy rate is practically nil.
So is it difficult to site entire parks? Is that what you're telling me? Is it some of the land use laws, or what causes this?
It's a combination, you bet, of land use. There's another bill here today that we may be asked to testify on regarding setbacks and the degree of density that can be afforded through a mobile home park. It's a combination of a lot of things, but land use is a big part of that. Yes, that's true.
Further questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. And close public hearing on House Bill 2085 and open up the work session. Any comments on this bill? Any committee members? Senator Starr?
I think just letting the result of the
Dyer, any further comments? Any members? Do you have any comments, Senator Miller? Or is there going to be back with them?
You go ahead.
So, you know, we're going to pass some of these things that way. Okay, well, Senator Starr moved that we move House Bill 2085 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any comments? Any objections to that? So, does anybody have a particular desire to carry this one?
I'd be happy to.
All right, we'll they need an emergency clause on this?
No. And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, you have in front of you a proposed amendment to the aid and growth type bill 2085. It looks like this.
Yeah, I guess perhaps we should reopen the work session on Senate Bill 2085.
Mr. Chair, I would move for reconsideration of passage of Senate Bill 2085.
Senator Byers moved for reconsideration of Senate Bill, or House Bill 2085, because we need to look at the emergency clause. Any comments, objections? So ordered. Now we have to talk about the dash one amendment.
Dash A2.
I guess I don't have that in my package. So
it's allowed to use after all.
Sure, I would move the dash A2 amendment.
Okay, the dash A2 amendments can moved on. Any comments? Objections? So ordered.
Chair,
I move
to
House Bill 2085 as amended to the floor of the Senate with due pass recommendation. Any comments? Yes.
One question. The tax treatment of these properties versus for-profit, anybody consider the impact on the local jurisdictions as to the, I assume, different treatment?
Mm-hmm.
Anybody wish to get in?
Yeah.
Should I show up and address that? Did you hear the question? Tax treatment of nonprofits versus profits as it relates to local jurisdictions?
This is Chair Senator Miller. There's an option that's available locally to exclude these properties from property tax assessment, but it is a local control issue. It requires 51% of the voting for the taxing district to agree to that before it is provided. So it is not an automatic property tax exemption whatsoever. It's truly up to the locals to decide whether they want to be sympathetic, provide that additional break. For instance, if it were a senior citizen park, or if they don't elect to do that, they don't have to.
Senator Byer.
And is that the method that a lot of the housing authorities are using to do the lease-to-own program?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, housing authorities have an outright property tax exemption as a result of being a government entity.
Okay. This is from the nonprofit magazine.
The other thing I was trying to quickly research is, you know, just exactly what constitutes a nonprofit and what problems are necessarily avoided by going that route. If I don't know if there are caps on how much the director, if there is one of a nonprofit organization, said I need to get a raise this year, or if the local governing body raises property taxes, has not exempted this property, who is going to shoulder that burden? I assume it would be the tenants, which would be similar to those that are run by profit organizations.
Chair Senator Miller, that's exactly right. If the property taxes go up, it has to be passed along to the tenants. What I would envision happening is the board of directors of that nonprofit would meet with the executive director of that nonprofit, discuss the situation, determine to what degree they may have reserves in place, that they can mitigate that tax increase over the course of time, or the immediacy of implementing that rental increase. Just like any corporation, they just aren't motivated by the additional profit factor that maybe other for-profit entities would be.
Except, I would think, that if you form nonprofit, and I know the Internal Revenue Service is taking a little more aggressive look at nonprofits now, especially in disclosing information, and I'm not suggesting anybody around here would engage in this activity, but if you want to exclude profits, you simply need to increase your expenses. And you can pay every member of the board that oversees the operation a little bit more by extracting a little bit more from all the tenants, and you can say you have no profit left over to pay any shareholders because there aren't any. Thought is, this is...
Yeah. Pat, would you like to come up and speak of this issue?
And is there information, I guess, with respect to the pay schedules for those who oversee, those who would act as directors of the nonprofit?
Please reintroduce yourself.
Yes, for the record, I'm Pat Schwach with Manufactured Homeowners. Mr. Chair and Representative Miller, Senator Miller. I guess I need to say that in the situation that we live in presently, where it is a for-profit operation, we've always paid the taxes, whether directly or indirectly, and in many cases we've paid the taxes when they dropped and we were told they went up. So I think that the tax problem for a nonprofit association, since we would all be shareholders, if you will, our one desire in life is to keep the rents where we can live with them. And I think that we've seen the rents consistently drop in these parks, most of them over since Measure 5, and I think that's probably a dirty word in this building, but in any event.
So in this situation, if I'm not mistaken, if you hired the director to oversee the operations in the park, you all would have a vote as to increasing, decreasing, or setting the salary of those individuals.
That's about it,
and that would be the comfort margin you think is provided by this as opposed to a private operation.
Yes, Senator Miller, Senator, my feeling is that once we were able to buy these corporations on our own, since we've all lived with the problems of the increased rents, that our big desire in life is to keep this park running as smoothly as possible, keeping in mind that we do have other obligations that will come along, such as streets and sidewalks and that kind of thing. But our big aim in life is to keep our rents to the place that what we're looking for is people who are on low incomes can manage to survive in this kind of a situation.
I might ask you, Tim, would you expect that if, upon the passage of this legislation, that you would be seeking the property tax exemption that the locals could grant?
Chairman Nelson and Senator Miller, I don't see any reason that we would particularly be, I may be off base, so, but this my own feeling, were I able to buy into this, is that I wouldn't have a problem paying my share of the property taxes. And I see no reason that they shouldn't be a part of the operation of the park, if you will. That's just my own feeling. That had never occurred to me, which was why I was doing, what's going on up here when I was sitting back here.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
Ann, do you have a comment on that?
I'm sure.
I mean, under what section would you form your nonprofit? I mean, if you did it under federal tax law, 501(c)(3) is... C3 is... Mm-hmm. Is that
501(c)(3) is the federal statute that there are comparable, I think it's chapter 65 or 66 in Oregon about state law.
Sure. Another gentleman here, I think, maybe has some answers for us. Or face it down and introduce yourself.
My name is Don Comstock, and I'm with Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, and I also represent myself. Yes, it would be a 501(c) corporation. Uniquely enough, it would be the very similar that corporation that is used when they use to build homes for Habitat. That same very section fits here. What it is, a governing body, traditionally most of the people would be non-profit or non-paid board members that oversee it and function from there. Not always the case, but most of the case, there are a few paid members. But traditionally what it's set up to do is to simply pass through all rises and costs straight to the homeowners, but yet keeping the profit issue down to a minimum or not at all.
Is there a question that Senator Miller asked about the taxing? How does that work?
Taxing would be, again, passed straight through to the tenants. It would not take anything off the rolls, with the exception of... Well, there is one. There would be no profit, so therefore there'd be no tax on that. But otherwise, increases in water and sewer pass through, property tax pass through, and so on. The appropriate levies would be passed through.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Well, we have a motion to remove House Bill 2085 as amended to the floor of the BCAR's recommendation. Any further comments? Any objections to that? So ordered. And Senator Metzger will carry. We will skip to Senate Bill 459 and open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 459. John Brenneman, Joe Brewer, and Don Miner. We move to Senate Bill 459. I ask John and Don to both come up.
There's too many people loving this bill for all of the
Okay. Go ahead, Joe. Why don't you start out, Joe, and with Joe. There's lots of gentlemen here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Brewer, Administrator of the Building Codes Division. Senate Bill 459 is a fairly simple, straightforward bill. It simply makes the mobile manufactured home park standard a statewide code for Oregon. It's one of the only standards that we have left that is not a statewide standard. This will help stabilize construction costs and will bring consistency between the Building Codes Division and all of the other jurisdictions throughout the state who administer manufactured home dwelling park programs. Currently, there are approximately 130 jurisdictions in the state. Approximately half of them have chosen to assume the responsibility for these programs, for this program. What the jurisdictions do is use our manufactured structures park program as a base requirement, a minimum requirement, and then add to that any particular requirements they may have in that jurisdiction. Obviously, that makes it difficult for some developers to get costs to estimate the time that it'll take to complete a project and makes them subject to perhaps the whims of some of those local jurisdictions that may not wish to have a park in their area. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions the community may have.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Joe. What items are covered under this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, my understanding, and I'm not an expert in this area, is that it basically deals with the layout, street width, spacing, setbacks of manufactured dwelling parks.
Will this preclude cities or counties from dealing with things like that? Some of them have a requirement that any houses be at least double wide. To deal with that, or are we talking about the infrastructure?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, I'd have to check on that specific question. I believe it deals more with the layout standards, roads, et cetera, for the park. But I will be happy to check and get back to the Senator, to the committee with that information.
Any questions?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association to speak in support of this legislation. I think Mr. Brewer sums it up very correctly. This adds the requirements of ORS 446062 to the list of codes that are peremptory in the state of Oregon. It does not apply to the homes within the park. At least that's our understanding. When you look at 062, it lists a number of statutes that drags in and those all relate to things such as street width, lighting, areas for children to play, things such as that. It also does not apply to subdivisions for manufactured homes. The state of Oregon has regulated the construction of manufactured home parks since about 1953, although it could be 59, I'm not sure which, but it's back there. As I said earlier, the rules relate to streets, lighting, drainage, fire separation, etc. And no city or county can have a standard that's lower than the state standard, but they can all have standards that, that exceed the state standard or differ from the state standard. And many cities have availed themselves of this opportunity. Sort of a one that sticks sideways in me is street standards. The state of Oregon has minimum street standards. And yet we have local governments adopting even, cities imposing city street standards in mobile home parks. So in essence, they're requiring that these roads be overbuilt. If it were, again, they're private streets, they should be designed to carry garbage trucks, manufactured homes, things such as that. But they're not going to be carrying city traffic. And in addition, they're never going to be turned back to the city or maintained by the city. So that we think that that standard is excessive. When the standards are excessive, those are costs that are passed on to our consumers, and it creates problems. I'm sure you've all heard about them during this session and in previous sessions, about our consumers have a limited ability to pay, so we want to reduce our costs where we can. There are other problems. When the state amends its standard, again, cities can't have a lesser standard, so they're all required to amend their standards. It would be helpful then if there was just one standard. In addition, the state of Oregon reviews applications to build parks in those cities that haven't assumed the program. I think Mr. Brewer said about half of them. That state employee must not only become familiar with the state standards, he must become familiar with the local standards. And we think that's somewhat burdensome. And there are precedents for a bill such as Senate Bill 459. The state building code, I think this is the best precedent. The state of Oregon, since the 1970s, has had a standard that was both a minimum and a maximum. No city or county can have a different standard than the state standard for buildings. Now, to the extent that there's something unique about a particular municipality, they can come to the state of Oregon and request relief, either, I guess, a forgiveness or even an amendment to the code. There's another precedent. Last legislature passed Senate Bill 849. That legislation made recreation vehicle parks a specialty code. And if you were to look at the bill on line, page 1, line 25, 455, 680, that was sort of the effect of that. And what that did was say that the state standard for recreation vehicle parks was both a minimum and a maximum. And we believe that while there's a great deal of difference between manufactured home parks and RV parks, there is some similarity, particularly from my point of view as a private road. If this legislation were to go forward and a municipality feels that the state standard is inadequate, they could petition to have the code amended. I believe that the state's undertaking that process as we speak. In conclusion, then, we support this bill. It will not apply to the homes. As I understand the way the peremptory nature of the code works, if the state hasn't spoken to a subject, then a municipality is free to regulate in that area. With that, I conclude my remarks.
Any questions? Yeah, sure.
Don, again, this is practically the local governments could not have a code that is more restrictive.
Neither more restrictive nor less restrictive, Mr. Chairman, Senator Byer.
So I'm looking at the section dealing with the 446.100, and it talks about the manufactured space being no less than 30 feet or greater than 40 feet. Does that become then that's the minimum and the maximum restriction that a local government could put on it here. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byer, I believe it is. There are also setback standards, though, that are found not in the statute itself, within the administrative rules that implement it. I doubt that you could build a space that would accommodate a modern manufactured home that was 30 feet in width.
I'm just trying to think out loud here a little bit, and I was thinking, again, that some of the local governments fairly common say they have to be at least double wide. It's probably mainly with selling by the industry now anyway. But wouldn't this, if you include the fire setback, which is 5 feet from each line, wouldn't that almost preclude the local government from having that requirement?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byer, that's not our intention here. I think you could also read this to say that since the statute doesn't speak to the size of the home, that a jurisdiction could require that it be a multi-section home. And so that the 30-foot width requirement, I think it's what falls away. At least that's our intention. It's not our intention whatsoever to preclude regulations on the types of homes that go within the communities. In fact, I think Oregon's output is about 97% multi-section, double and triple section homes.
Questions? The city has an existing regulation now. What is the statute? What is this proposed statute do to that? Does it change it at all?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it would. It would prevent them from imposing a standard if it conflicted with the state standard.
So they've already got the standard in place, and they'd have to repeal the standard. That's what you're saying?
They'd
have to confirm it.
Yes.
Okay. Have you had any conversations with any of the city people about this possibility?
Mr. Chairman, no, we have not. I believe they were aware of the hearing. I assume that they have come.
Any further questions?
Well, I was wondering, Mr. Chair, maybe Joe might just add some more clarification. for the question that Senator Beyer had on Dawes in terms of the space. Our moving forward guy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, Senator Beyer, again, I believe that does lay out the specifics of a typical manufactured home space within a park. I'll check with our technical expert to make sure. But I don't believe the intent is to preclude any jurisdiction from requiring a double wide home, and I have that note. I'll get back to the committee with an answer.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jeff Payne. I'm a developer and operator of parks, and much of my testimony has been stated already. However, I'm under the development of two parks right now where requirements are in excess of the statewide standards. And I've looked at that and tried to relate that back to a rental number per lot, and where in two occasions I'm required to build at least a 30-foot wide street. It depends a little bit on whether there would be two homes facing the street or just one. That could range between $8 and $16 per month as a factor of cost to build an extra wide street. Concrete sidewalks being imposed, I have one requirement now for 3-foot sidewalks, the other one for 5-foot sidewalks, and that would be about $9 per home per month. Also, in one county, I'm required to build subdivision-style curbs, and that would be about $10 per home per month. So there's quite an impact for these stiffer regulations. I also have in one development a change in city policy, which is going to require a different type of water system. Mm-hmm. The city wants to require that we build up to the public standards. And by doing that, it's going to cost about $2,000 per home to build, or about $33 per month. Responding to another question I heard, maybe I could eliminate that in terms of minimum width for a multi-section or double-wide home. It would depend on what size of carport or garage you would have. We typically design them, at least for single-car garages, at 12 feet, and that would put your minimum lot width at about 49 feet. Thank you.
Any further questions? Please introduce yourself again for the record.
Hi, I'm Don Comstock, and thank you for the opportunity. I'm past president of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, MHCL. I also am a developer and a community owner and a manager. And one of our biggest issues is the cost of pastures. When developing a new community, the biggest key is those costs that are put on us, as was mentioned before me, all pile up. So when rents begin to get over a certain point, and then you begin to add a fee for pass-throughs at some time later, it's not uncommon to hear of rents over 400 or higher. And those are simply imposed on us. And it's very difficult to explain to people, whether they be tenants or others, that those costs are a burden on us when we build. The curbs, it's not uncommon to hear a curb, even though uniquely when you say you put a curb in there and then you go to put a 20,000-pound manufactured home, and particularly one half of it, what they call a heavy house, goes across that curb and breaks it out, then you have to tear it out and put it back in. And it's not uncommon to have that happen, even after it's built. So those costs, again, are passed on through as you begin to go on. And actually, they multiply our costs of doing business, and it makes it difficult to, do business, simply because of the fact that it's, frankly, in some ways, cheaper to build apartment houses, if you want to know the truth, than it is to build a manufactured housing community. Apartment houses are not built under the same standards we are, because we're not under the city code or the street code, whereas apartment house is not usually in that same code. I'd ask that you pass this bill on through. And thank you for your time.
Thank you for coming. I guess the question was asked earlier that one of the problems with land use laws that there's not enough available space. Would this statute go to any extent to resolve that problem, or is that even not even an issue?
No, this will not help the land use laws. What's going to help is having some sort of change with LUBA or the local statutes when it comes to planning and so forth. Otherwise, that big sticky wicket.
Any further questions?
You, just based on your testimony here, do you feel that the restriction imposed on the building of these new parks in so doing limits those who get into the business of having a mobile home park community? And is there, do you believe, a cause and effect relationship between some of the escalating costs that I know some of the tenants feel just because there's not enough choice around?
Yes. When it comes down to it, I'm a businessman, and I look at it. I'm going to say, I got apartment houses here, and the bottom line is here, and it's going to produce these dollars. And I've got a manufactured housing community, and the costs are so, and it's going to produce these dollars. The cheapest one, frankly, is going to win in building, and the one that's going to give me the best return over time is going to win. And traditionally, as these things have escalated and changed, unfortunately, communities lose. They're getting harder and harder to build because the standards are so unique. You go in one day, I won't mention the municipality. I went in one day, got everything laid out, walked out, come in a month later and said, okay, here's the plan. And they said, oh, by the way, we changed that. You're going to have to redo this. So you have to go back to engineering and do it all again simply because they changed it. There's no set guidelines for us to stay with them, and it's up to them to make their own decisions, and that's not an unwise thing to do. It's just that it makes it very difficult that when you're building to produce any kind or to even save costs. You can't get creative enough to save the cost.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much for your time. We have Larry Kemper, Jerry Dixon again.
Just the rest of my choir.
Okay.
I don't want them to
come up and
say the same thing.
Okay. That's fine. If there's anything you want to add, John, or is there good? Any further? Let's just close the public hearing then on about 4:59. Did everybody get an opportunity to sign up the one to testify? I think they did. Okay. We'll open up our work session on Senate Bill 459. Comments?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I think the comments that have made on the infrastructure make a lot of sense. And I know that sometimes some communities have used infrastructure requirements, frankly, as a way to get around allowing mobile home parks because the legislature specifically provided that you could site a mobile home park or a mobile home lot anywhere that's zoned residential and community. So I know that there have been some attempts to circumvent that. My only concern is I think there are some legitimate zoning issues in terms of buffering that sometimes exist. In looking at the statute, I feel comfortable that those issues are not going to be a problem here, although I think it's still things that Joe Brewer and the department are going to have to look at it. I guess the basic thing is there aren't any city or county people here testifying in opposition, so I assume they must like it. So given that, I would move approve Senate Bill 459 and move to the floor to speak there.
Senate Bill 459 has been moved to the floor to be passed. There are no amendments for this. Any areas for the comments? Any objections? So, Diana Sherrier. Anybody?
Sure.
Senator Byer would carry that. Thank you, sir. Okay, we'll open up a public hearing on actually six bills, Senate Bill 648, Senate Bill 647, Senate Bill 650, Senate Bill 1087 and Senate Bill 1088 and Senate Bill 1248. And we have a list of witnesses here. Okay. So we'll start with the Housing Service people, Dave Sheeler and Jean Arana. I sort of masticated that one, didn't I? Yeah, that's all right. It appears that these bills all have some sort of interconnection or something. If you have some specific reference to a specific bill, please notify us or please take note of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Jean Arana with the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. With me is Dave Sheeler, who is with the Manufactured Dwelling Park Ombudsman Program. And we are here to speak in support of the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 648 while remaining neutral on the bill overall. We have met several times with representatives of the requesters of the bill. Initially, they had come and wanted to share with us the fact that they wanted to raise the assessment by $3 on the manufactured dwelling. And we sat down with them and talked about what kinds of things could be done with that additional increase. We recognize that there's a real strong desire in the original bill on the part of the requesters to lock in some specificity on what the ombudsman program does. We shared that language with the attorney, D. Carlson, for the department, and he indicated that he felt that the original bill language was redundant, that those duties and responsibilities are already covered by statute that covers and governs the ombudsman program. So we are in support of those -1 amendments to remove that redundancy. We also felt that the committee would be interested in knowing, even though we are neutral as a department on the bill, wanting to know what we would do with those additional revenues should you choose to pass the bill. And we have entered those on the back page of our testimony, and we have some dollar figures that we could share with you if you so desire.
Yes. Could you just quickly?
Yes, I would turn those over to Dave Sheeler.
Welcome, Dave.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is David Sheeler. I'm the Manufactured Dwelling Park Ombudsman for the state of Oregon. Do you want me to address, Mr. Chair, just the question?
Sure.
Okay. The question was?
Funding. You said there may be funding issues.
Sure. Let me explain, if I might, Mr. Chairman, about how we are funded initially. Can I do a brief overview of that?
Let me
ask. The 1989 Oregon State Legislature created the Manufactured Dwelling Park Ombudsman Program. We were created for three primary purposes: to provide technical assistance to park patrons, general information, referral resources about park facilities, and promote improvements in landlord and tenant relationships. There's currently about 1,500 parks in the state of Oregon with over 63,000 spaces for Oregonians to live. The Manufactured Dwelling Ombudsman Program is a division of Oregon Housing and Community Services as a state of Oregon agency. We provide each year as a program services directly to over 3,000 individuals that contact or call us for assistance. Now, straight to the funding part of this, the Manufactured Dwelling Ombudsman Program is funded through a special assessment that's levied annually upon each manufactured dwelling that is assessed as personal property. The current amount of that assessment is $3 per space per year. The assessor of each county collects this assessment, and it becomes the operating revenue for the Manufactured Ombudsman Program. Then, was your question, Mr. Chair, about how much we receive currently?
Well, that, and I guess it's in the testimony, you're getting $260,000.
That's correct.
Okay. And so then with this raise, you're going to be looking at $520,000.
Double that amount, that's correct. We're currently a group of three individuals that's comprised of a program representative, a program specialist, and myself to provide those services. I can talk, Mr. Chair, if you want, to the type of services we think we will increase, if you want.
That's fine, I think. Okay, I guess, well, staff, why don't you, Sherry, why don't you ask that question? So I make sure we get it right.
Just want to be clear, if the bill passes for the, in a different bill, that there is an increase in assessment, would the department have the ability to hire additional staff and spend the additional money to engage in the activities as proposed in the Dash 1 amendment?
It's our understanding that that would need to be in another amendment, the spending authority.
We'd have to give you spending authority then?
Yes.
Okay. Anything else?
Mr. Chair, if I might,
Sure.
On the second page where it talks about those things that the department would be willing and would agree to do, it was recommended by the attorney that we could enter into a letter of understanding to provide some assurance to those people who are assessed that this is the way the money would be spent, and that is what that language speaks to.
Yeah.
They trust Mr. Sheeler, and they would like to make sure that the services he currently provides continue, and that provides some level of assurance.
You said, what, 3,000 complaints, calls, maybe not complaints, at least calls,
Chairman,
inquiries?
That's correct. It's approximately 3,000 contacts to our program currently.
That's per year?
Per year. What the desire is, I believe, as we've met with the landlords and tenant trade groups of the state of Oregon, is for us to have an opportunity to reach a wider population of the state of Oregon. Before you, we've put brochures that talk about our program and what we do. There are two brochures that are currently underway there. They explain for anyone who wants to read those in the arena of manufactured dwelling tenancies the nature of what people can and cannot do in manufactured housing environments. We're trying to get that information as broad as we can to as many people as we can and do so with the revenue that's provided to the program. An additional revenue source to the program will allow us a larger opportunity to do that statewide. And that's part of, that's one of the things that the landlord and tenant trade groups asked of us to do as this legislation was put together, to try to find a way to notify and create a vehicle to get people on track with what's going on.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We call it Frank Burleson, John Van Landingham, and Landingham, and Pat Schrock, and Glenn Grover. Welcome, and please introduce yourselves again, and if you're coming out on one of the specific bills, please let us know.
Yes, I'm Frank Burleson with the Residents Coalition, and perhaps as the chronological senior of this whole group here, and the fact that this is my swan song legislative session, perhaps it's appropriate that I should lead off. I have two major interests, major interests in this panorama of bills before you. One of them you have just been talking about, SB 648, the so-called ombudsman's increase in funding. And incidentally, it's interesting that that would increase the payment into the ombudsman's fund by each mobile home park representative. It would increase it from 25 cents a month to 50 cents a month, which is not a considerable increase by any measure. However, the benefits that would derive from that are enormous. You know, we out here in the vast reaches of our wonderful state are many, many mobile home parks that have no idea of the services that are available to them. They have no idea of the mediation services that the Ombudsman's Office can provide. And as one of the originators of this bill about a year and a half ago, I feel vitally interested and urge you very strongly to pass this bill forward. I think there's hardly anything we could do, we as the government could do, that would benefit the mobile home park arena than the passage of this bill. The other thing that I have interest in is the the Dash 1 amendment to 1088. I want to say first off that we need to know how much work has gone in on this one particular part of 1088, the amendments of 1088, and this has to do with the so-called delayed force removal provisions that have been in existence. I hesitate to use that term because the park owners aren't particularly pleased with it. And of course, you pick your terms. But we started work on this bill just 2 months after the 1995 legislative session. And in 1997, we started a series of meetings with the park owners. And we had 18 meetings on this particular item, how we can protect residents' investment in parks at the time that they begin to move along, and how we can also honor the park owner's need to update the curb appeal of his park. Both groups are interested in both of those things. And we have come to a compromise after an additional 20 meetings this year, each of one of which was at least 2 hours in length. So, you know, you've got something here that represents a real coalition of thought. This would not have been possible had it not been perhaps for the efforts and the input of two persons, and I want to mention those two because you deserve to know who they are. The first one of them is Dave Shearer, who was the facilitator of all these meetings, both in 1997 and in 1999. And he deserves real credit for keeping this disparate group of people together. Okay? You know, in 1993, we wouldn't even speak to each other. In 1995, it was pretty much the same thing. In 1997, we began to say hello to each other in the hall, and now I get a kiss on the cheek from some of them. You know, it's very nice.
Wow, this is progress.
Surely, from sitting down across the table and in civil fashion, you, in large part today, it's Sheila's ability to keep us in a friendly mode. We've done that. Now, the other person that I think owes is due a great deal of credit is sitting at the other end of the table here, John Van Landingham of Lane County Legal Aid. He has written draft after draft after draft, in particular on this delayed forced removal. We were on draft number 15 when we finally reached agreement, and I think this man deserves, you know, real credit for having had the intestinal fortitude to come forth with these things again and again and again. And I think I've taken up enough of your time. I'm not going to comment on the actual technicalities of the bill. There's people far more capable of doing that. But thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for all your work, too. Pat?
Yes, for the record, I'm manufactured homeowners. Next time he won't be the senior member and he can't steal my thunder. 1088 has been one of those bills that, as Frank said, we worked on forever and ever. And had it not been for Dave Shealar keeping us together when somebody was so mad they could have run somebody else's neck, we'd have never gotten to where we got. And as I watched John Van Landingham present draft after draft and somebody come in and tweak it, and he'd have to go back and rewrite it. And as I said in my original testimony, I think he should be up for sainthood. Somebody else would have killed us long since. This was a terribly important issue to us because we're seeing that homes that are still very livable homes were being removed from the park. And we've set it up now so that this will not happen. I'm the first person to say that if a home becomes a safety issue or it begins to look like Tobacco Road, then it needs to be gotten out of the park for everybody's sake. But in so many cases, some of these older homes were being removed, and they were perfectly livable homes. and so it has been a great step forward to have resolved this issue and gotten it so it's something we can all live with. As far as the other, the ombudsman's bill that we're referring to, the extra $3, when I see the good work that comes out of that office and the things that they do to keep some of us from being in court because we're mad at the landlord and he's mad at us and we couldn't resolve the issue because we didn't know there was some other way to do it. So that's a very important issue for us. The rest of the bills that we have in here, I'm obviously for them or we wouldn't have sponsored them. If you need some additional testimony as we go along, I'll be happy to give it. And thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Pat. Question?
John? Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Van Landingham. I live in Eugene, where I am a constituent of Senator Beyer. I work as a lawyer for a nonprofit law firm, Lane County Law and Advocacy. I'm the drafter of 1088. I'm also the drafter of what is now 1248, but I'm here to speak on 1088 only. The Parental Tenant Act was adopted by the legislature in 1973. It was initially aimed at all tenancies. In 1975, the legislature recognized that manufactured housing tenancies required some special treatment, primarily because the tenants own their homes, and it costs a lot of money to move them, and it's very difficult to move them or to find a space to move them to. So manufactured housing tenants have special protections. What 1088 does is amend those special statutes, which are aimed at manufactured housing tenancies in facilities, as well as floating home tenancies in marinas. One of our goals for a number of years, at least the resident goals for a number of years, has been to have their own chapter, because right now those two tenancies are tied together. This bill advances that cause a bit by creating some new statutes which address landlord access to a tenant's space, the space the tenant rents to put the home on, a tenant's duties, a landlord's duties with regard to maintaining the space. And there are a couple of other substantive changes. Of the 27 sections of the bill, only about 10 of them are substantive. I don't want to take your time up by reviewing them. If there are questions, substantive questions, I think I'm the person to be asked. The one thing I would note for you is that there are some technical corrections which will need to be made to the bill. The work group that's worked on these this bill has agreed that we would ask you to move this bill forward and we would make those corrections on the House side. Thank you.
Yeah. Could you just quickly summarize the key points you said? There's what, 8 or 10, something like that.
Could, Mr. Chair, I could. The first substantive provision is in Section 2, Facility Access. It's in, you've got two documents to look at here. You've got the main bill, 1088, and you've got the statute. And the substantive sections are mixed between the two. The reason for that is that we didn't finish negotiating until March of this year. The 15th Amendment took us a while. 15th threat took us a while to get here.
Right?
Clear, John, then the dash one is not a complete sentence, though.
Mr. Chair, Senator Breyer, that's correct. You will need to pass both the bill and the dash one. And there will now need to be a dash two to make the technical arrangements corrections, but we would do that on the House side. But you would need to pass both the bill and the dash one. The dash one only includes the changes, does not include the body of 1088.
And the dash two, is that?
I have not seen the dash two, but it looks like one line.
Mr. Chair, Senator Byers, the dash two is just a minor adjustment that LC prepared, and I'd be happy to provide a copy to you if you have it on the access to it.
I received that. Mr. Chair, I would note that I received my copy of the dash one from Senator Byers' home Sunday afternoon, and I've been spending the last 12 hours reading it. And I haven't seen the dash two.
It takes that long.
Well, you have to work with legislative counsel to appreciate that. That looks fine. That actually looks fine. Back to the substance that I was asked to briefly review. Section 2 of 1088, not the dash 1, but the main bill, 1088, is a description of a landlord's right to enter the space. Again, in this tenancy, the tenant owns the home. So there is already an access statute which applies to general tenancies. And in a general tenancy, it makes sense that the landlord would have the right also to enter the apartment, for example. But in this situation, the landlord, the group agrees, should not have the right to enter the tenant's private home, the manufactured dwelling itself. So we have taken the base statute, the general landlord-tenant facility access statute, 90.322, and amended that to fit facility tenancies. And primarily, what we're providing is the landlord has the right to enter the space, but not the home. There are some other variations that we've made to the base statute, 90.322. We're adding a right for the landlord to enter the space to do groundskeeping without advance notice, a right for the landlord or a landlord's agent to enter the space in case of an emergency. But otherwise, it is quite similar to the main statute for access, except recognizing we're talking about the space and not the home itself. Section 3 of the main bill, 1088, is also a substantive section, and that describes some statutory duties that a tenant would have. It is modeled after 90.325, which applies to general tenancies, and is a statutory list of tenant duties, such as to maintain the unit. Again, because what the tenant is renting here is a space and owning the home, most of the duties that we've listed in Section 3 have to do with maintaining the space. Some of them have to do with maintaining the home as well. For example, making sure that the home has a smoke alarm and is free from fire hazards. But otherwise, many of them have to do primarily with the space. For example, one of the subsections requires that the tenant maintain the trees, the grass, the shrubbery on the space, if there are any. In a facility tenancy, the landlord's habitability duties relate to providing utility hookups. In other words, the landlord would provide a sewage system hookup. And the tenant's duty here, as covered in Section 3, is to make the connection to that hookup. That's obviously quite different from a general tenancy in which the landlord also has to provide the toilet and make sure the toilet works. In this case, the tenant owns the toilet, and it's the tenant's problem to make sure that works. Forced removal, an unpopular term, and go to Section 6, which is facility habitability. This is the flip side of the tenant duty. This facility habitability is the landlord's responsibility for maintaining it. In general tenancy, the landlord is responsible for maintaining the unit, the apartment, in a habitable condition, such as making sure that there is a toilet and that it works. Here, the landlord's responsibility would be making sure that there is a sewage disposal system and a connection to the space that the tenant can hook up to. Prior to the statute, we did not have a habitability section which made clear the distinction in the two kinds of tenancies, and so it was a very awkward fit, since clearly the landlord had no duty to maintain the home, and yet the only habitability statute talked about the landlord's duty to maintain the home. So what we've done here with facility habitability is to make it clear that the landlord's duties primarily relate to maintaining the connections to the space, making sure that the space is safe when the tenant rents it, completing any improvements that the landlord promised that would be provided, such as sidewalks, and also maintaining the common area in the facility. Section 4, nicer term is termination and removal. And what that does is regulate a landlord's ability, restrict a landlord's ability to force a tenant or a purchaser from the tenant to remove a home due to certain factors regarding the home, such as age, size, style, or compliance with the federal manufactured housing standards. It then goes forward to describe how a landlord can terminate a tenancy for disrepair of the home. Manufactured housing tenancies can only be terminated for cause. Cause could be the conduct of the tenant. It could be the condition of the home. This new Section 6.4 will authorize a landlord to terminate a tenancy and force removal of the home due to the condition of the home, not the age and the size and the materials, because that's not deterioration, just because it's older or smaller. But if the home is deteriorated, the landlord now can get a 30-day full cause termination notice. The tenant has 30 days to fix that problem, cure the problem. We are, for the first time, providing a right for a tenant to extend by 60 days that period to make a correction. If, for example, the problem is peeling paint, and you can't paint due to the rain and Oregon's winters, and you could get a 60-day extension to do that. Or if the repair work is so extreme, so much is necessary, or there aren't the right workers available, you could get an extension for 60 days to do that work, too. So Section 4 is a comprehensive look at repair issues that might prompt the termination. I think those are the most important of the changes, substantive changes in the bill.
Okay, any questions? Thank you very much for the testimony. Len Grover, get a chance to testify. Len?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Sally Harrington, Sean Fleming Dart, and Don Comstock. Welcome. Please introduce yourselves.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Sally Harrington. I am legislative representative for the Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. I'm also vice president of Commonwealth Property Management, and we manage over 70 mobile home parks, manufactured housing communities in the state of Oregon. I'm here, obviously, in support of 1088. We have spent, as has been indicated by prior testimony, an enormous amount of time on this bill. And I would like to add my thank you to St. John's and Landingham and the Residents Association for their work in this. We have decided after last legislative session that this was an issue that definitely needed to be addressed, but we wanted to be able to spend the time to do it correctly. The residents have contributed their side of it. We, as the landlords, have been able to look at both sides of the issue. Some of the issues in this bill is simple house cleaning, and some of it as the termination removal was something that definitely needed to be addressed in our industry. I would request that and urge you please to support this bill. I would also like to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 648. I can't even begin to tell you how valuable the Ombudsman's program has become to park owners, not only in mediation but in education issues. It's so nice to know that we can go and mediate an issue rather than go to court and spend thousands of dollars and the trauma and stress of a court hearing and be able to settle the issues in the Ombudsman's office. So I definitely would encourage that you support that bill. Senate Bill 1087-1, I would ask you to support that bill and move it out today. That basically, we had originally had four issues in that bill, came down to one issue, and that is that in the event that a home sells, any monies owing the landlord will be paid at the time of the sale of the home. I had talked to Pat Schlock, and the Residents Association does not have a problem with that request either. Any of the other bills that you'd like to ask questions on, I'll be more than happy to answer them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Sharon Fleming Barrett, Legislative Director for the Oregon Rental Housing Association and its 3,500 members statewide. I have given you some prepared remarks. I'm not going to testify on all eight bills, much to your delight. The easy ones, vote yes, please. 459, 648, 2085, and 1088. 1088, as you have heard from several people so far, is a negotiated bill. We did a lot of hard work. We got great gains for both landlords and tenants in Senate Bill 1088. There are a number of clarifications in that bill that will benefit both sides. There are some things that will benefit the tenant advocates and the tenants. There are some things that will benefit the rental property owners and the rental property owner's attorneys. We still urge you to vote yes on 1088 with the dash 1 and dash 2 amendments. And I, again, would be one of the supporters of the saint and his hard work. It's a hard subject. Until you have worked on these committees with Mr. Van Landingham, you cannot imagine how we all feel. We're being very flippant about the amount of work he's done, but we're all very sincere in our admiration for him. Even though he works for Lane County Law and Advocacy Center, we all consider John a friend and somebody who puts his heart and soul into the work that we all play at. So we truly appreciate him. The hard testimony, the opposing positions. Senate Bill 647, our Association opposes. It would have a requirement that keeps landlords from evicting tenants for non-payment of rent when that tenant's retirement check is misplaced because of Y2K. Our only concern about this bill is who is going to protect the property owner from foreclosure by the banks, who's going to protect both the tenants and the property owner for cessation of services when the landlord who doesn't get the rent can't pay the bills. Those are our concerns about 647. We oppose 647 in its current version. We'd be glad to work on amendments to give protections to both sides or to see a companion bill. But as it is currently written, we as an organization have to oppose that bill. Senate Bill 650. Senate Bill 650 sounds like a simple bill that requires certain disclosures by the landlord. It would require the disclosure of the property owner's name and address in the statement of policy, which would go not just to people who actually rent from that landlord, but to anybody who's considering renting from that landlord. If this bill were amended so that it was a disclosure to tenants only, we could support it. But right now, the policy and some of the changes that we've made in other laws say that the policy statement has to go to every prospect before signing a rental agreement. That could be a lot of paperwork to a lot of people who have no intention of renting at that property. And those are our concerns about 650. And then the very hard one, Senate Bill 1248. Senate Bill 1248 contains a prohibition on landlords terminating the tenancy of manufactured homes or floating homes due strictly to the condition of that home. That's our objection. This was a hard-fought, very well-discussed issue in the negotiating group. We purposely excluded the word condition from 1088 because we want to protect not just the property owner but the other residents. As Pat Schwab testified, we have grave concerns about allowing our properties to have neighbors in the facilities that allow their unit to run down. We have to support, or we have to oppose 1248 in its current writing for that reason. We want you to urge you to oppose that bill. Vote yes on 1088. You have my prepared comments. Thank you very much for the time to be heard here today.
Thank you very much. Question?
I have one.
Yes, sorry.
On Senate Bill 650. You were talking about the notices for prospective and existing tenants. But in the copy that I have, the draft of it, line 6, is prospective and existing. Those words are dropped out. And it says simply tenants as required under subsection 3 of this section. So that could you clarify that with me from what you said?
Chair Nelson, Senator Metzger, perhaps I haven't seen those amendments.
Well, it's in the draft of the original bill that I have. Do you have a copy of it?
I do have.
Okay.
Chair Nelson, Senator Metzger, the changes that I was referring to are in 1088. In 1088, we negotiated a section that says that the policy statement would be given before the tenant was committed in any way to the property, or the applicant was committed in any way to the property, and that would include a copy of the policy statement and any rental agreement that might be used. So those two bills, I'm afraid, would mean we would have to give the owner's name, address, and other information to people who were simply walking by and inquiring. That's our concern.
Right. Well, I understand that. That's been taken care of for 1088, but you said you objected to 650 because of the prospective language, and I'm just pointing out that that has been deleted in 650, if that was the only concern that you had about that.
Chair Nelson, Senator Metzger, my concern has to do with the line that deals with before entering into a rental agreement. I don't believe that it's clear. Those are our only concerns on that bill.
Okay, Mr. Chair. If you get a copy of that, you can have my copy. I just like to, since that's the only issue we have here, I'd like to clarify if I'm confused about something. Or, you know, do you have another copy of 650?
Yeah. We're going to get you a copy of that. So
it says, if I can, Mr. Chair, it just says in line 5, Every landlord who rents a space for a manufactured dwelling or floating home shall provide a written statement of policy to, and then deleted prospective and existing. So it changed to say policy to tenants as required that shall contain the following information in permit form, and then it goes through those issues. But the prospective is deleted.
Yeah, we'll give you an opportunity to look at those.
Yes, I'll be busy.
Any further questions? Yes.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that that's addressed in 1088. If that's addressed in 1088 and we're all supporting that bill, I don't know that 650 is redundant.
Well, I think we better look at it just to make sure that everybody is on the same page with this thing. Well, we get along so well, so
I would like to once again express my sincere appreciation to all the people that worked on this committee, both landlord and residents, and I am one of the people that just sank on the chief, by the way. It was not David Cheadle, but he was addressing. Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, that's very good. I'm happy to see that you folks are working together, because it is a very complex and emotional issue, so appreciate that.
Mr. Nelson, I do have the response at this time.
Okay.
My concern has to do with page 2, line 4. The landlord shall provide a copy of the statement of policy to a prospective tenant.
Okay. So that's the language.
They did take it out in the first section, but they added it back in later on, and that's our concern.
Okay.
Uh-huh. All right. I'm glad
we covered that. Now, if that were changed, would that answer your concern?
Sure, Nelson. Senator Metzger, it would. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. That's great. Anybody?
I'm curious about your objection to that. What do you think the policy... What do you think the potential tenants should want them to know what the corporate policies were before they signed the lease agreement?
Chair Nelson, Senator Beyer, yes, we do, and that is why in 1088 we have put that in, that at the outset of the negotiation of a tenancy, the property owner or manager will disclose and will hand the prospective tenant. What our concern is disclosing the owner information before there's a tenancy. And that's what this bill is about, is strictly the disclosure of the owner's name and address. We don't believe that there is a need to hand the owner's name and address to every passerby.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We have Don Miner and Joe Brewer signed up. I'll give you an opportunity here if you want to say something. And let them testify first, and then we'll get back to you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Don Miner, on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. I'd like to limit my remarks to 1088 and 1248, if I may. Many members of our association, we have a great deal of interest in landlord-tenant relationships. In working on these measures, our interests were more focused on the resident's ability to leave his home within the park. Amongst our members are the institutions of financing, and so there's a keen interest in seeing that home stay so that it can be bought and sold, and that ultimately the mortgage could be repaid. We also have a keen interest in seeing that the facility be maintained so that the home isn't destroyed by water accumulations, etc. In 1088, I think it's section, the Dash 1 Amendment, section 4, allows the resident to leave his home in the park virtually forever, so long as he pays the rent, obeys the rules, obeys the law, and he maintains his home in a good condition. We had reports of homes being forced to be moved from the home based solely on their age. With some considerable frequency, homes were being forced to be moved because they were built pre-June 15, 1976. That's not very long ago. Probably the mortgage hasn't even been satisfied once on some of those homes. So what the bill does now is say that the resident can leave his home there so long as it's maintained. And we think that's fair. To the extent that the landlord has a concern with the maintenance of the home, he can give the resident a notice, and the resident is given an opportunity to cure that defect. If the resident fails to cure it and abandons the home, then a subsequent lien holder or an existing lien holder of record can come in subsequent to that abandonment and make those repairs and leave the home there and then sell it in place as if he were the resident. There had been another bill, Senate Bill 1248, that the group could not come to an agreement on. Under the current framework in Chapter 90, generally, a resident has a perpetual hold on the land that stays forever so long as he pays rent, obeys the rules, etc. There is a wrinkle to that law that essentially is being read to say, now we're not sure we agree with this reading, but that if a resident signs a fixed-term lease, for instance, a 10-year lease, at the end of that leasehold, his tenancy is terminated and the home is, can be required to be removed from the park. What 1248 would have done was convert that back into a month-to-month residency, and that was something we would like to have seen occur. The group could not come to an agreement on that, and we're willing to work in the interim and later, if it takes that, to resolve that issue. And with that, I conclude my remarks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Brewer. I'm the administrator of the Building Codes Division. Building Codes has been involved in this work group activity for some time during the interim. We do support the bill in that it will provide for safer living conditions. Issues such as working smoke alarms in all manufactured dwellings are of importance to the division. We do have one small amendment we'd like to offer. We've spoken to the proponents, and we're comfortable with dealing with that on the House side if the committee chooses to move the bill. And that's Senate Bill 1088, excuse me.
Questions of this man? Thank you very much. Sir, you had you want to make a comment?
My name is Len Grover, and I'm a mobile homeowner and a member, district director for Oregon Manufactured Homeowners Association. I passed up an opportunity a minute ago to talk about two bills. I thought we were taking them in order, so I had no objection to that. We bring up an objection here, or somebody brought up an objection to 650 with regards to the owner's name being in the statement of policy. The statement of policy should be made available to everyone, prospective tenants and tenants alike, because, and I've been involved in two or three situations, gentlemen and ladies, when you move into a manufactured housing village, or you move into a condominium, or any other type of living facility, you're actually moving into a new little political subdivision. When I moved into my condominium, those people had a right to control my life by passing rules and regulations I had to abide by. They also had a right to enforce a tax on me because my homeowner's fee was subject to go up or down at the whim of the board of directors. My rent now goes up, doesn't go down, it goes up at the whim of the park owner. I have to have a right to see what I'm going to be faced with before I move in to that facility. I need to know the rules and regulations that they're going to expect me to abide by. I need to know the statement of policy. I know how the park runs and so forth. So I think it's very important that we don't do anything to restrict information going to a prospective tenant. There are some information if I had had, and I'm not going to say this is in the statement of policy, but had I known 18 months ago what I know now, I would not have moved into a manufactured home village. But that information wasn't available to me then. Now that I'm there, I'm going to fight for my rights. Now, if we're going to talk about all these bills at one time, I'd just like to make a summation. I'm very much in favor of, and I've got them all mixed up now, the forced removal issue. And I'm not even aware that it is in 1088, but all the other people testifying said that it's in there. I can't find it. I'll take your word for it being there.
Probably an amendment. It's a dash to amendment.
Very, very important to people in the mobile home park. One thing that hasn't been mentioned is that there is not very seldom a restriction on an owner is not necessarily going to be forced to move his home. In many parts, that's the case. What happens is if the owner decides to sell his mobile home, the park owner then will tell the prospective buyer that when he gets ready to sell that home again, it will have to be moved out of the park. No prospective buyer in his right mind is going to go ahead and consummate that buying or that agreement to buy. So if it's my home and I'm selling it to you and you can't sell it without moving out of the park, you're going to come back to me and say, hey, we don't have a deal. And that has resulted in driving the price of my home down to zero. If I can't sell it to somebody that can resell it, then my home has no value to anybody except me. And if I can't stay in the park due to infirmities or age or the fact that I just want to move out, then I'm stuck with a home that has no value because I can't be sold. So the forced removal issue is very, very important. I'm very much in favor of 648. My questions on that was why these amendments took a whole lot of that bill out. It's a redundancy factor I can understand and would approve. Senate Bill 647, I think, is terribly important. One of the people testifying said that there was no protection for the park owner in case of Y2K proposition, but the park owner is in a far better position to go back to his mortgage holder and get some consideration there than the little old lady that lives in a mobile home is if she doesn't get her Social Security check on time. This is probably a moot point, gentlemen, because 3 weeks ago I read an article in the paper that President Clinton promised that all Social Security checks would be delivered on time. And certainly we can trust that. regarding Senate Bill 1087, I am concerned with some of the language in there. If there is an absence of a rental agreement by both the tenant and the park owner, and I have a hard time understanding how the park owner would lose his tenant agreement since he's a businessman and has file cabinets and so forth and probably computers. I can understand a little old lady again, or a little old man. I'm not trying to say anything that I shouldn't say here. A little old man like me, I could lose my rental agreement. And therefore, it would have to be, could be renegotiated if the park owner really lost his. But in the event that that should happen, I would think that there might be someone else in that park who had negotiated a rental agreement at about the same time I did that would be very, very much like mine. And that could be used as a guideline for negotiating a new rental agreement. Now, it says in the bill that the new rental agreement would not materially diminish the existing rights enjoyed by the tenant. That is subject to a lot of an interpretation. So maybe if that was in there with the right of the ombudsman's office to determine if there was a conflict there, that he would settle that dispute on whether that new rental agreement was a proper rental agreement that did not take away the rights that were already being enjoyed. So I would suggest that to whoever it is that might be amending and so forth these bills. There's also a fact in 1087, I understand that there is a provision there to eliminate the restriction on the ability of landlord to require tenant payment and utility charge, and I would be very much opposed to the elimination of that restriction. I do think that the landowner has, or the park owner certainly has the right to require all payments of rents, fees, deposits, and charges owed prior to a sale. Stick houses have title surveys that provides all that information, so that has to be taken care of at the time of closure. In a mobile home, there's no such thing as that, so I think the park owner has the right to his due process there.
I guess that's all I had to say.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Len, very much. Let's see. Pat, did you have something that you wanted to say? I thought you had noticed some things. Did you want to comment on any of these bills?
I always have something to say.
For the record,
yes, sir. I noticed when we got into 650 that there was quite a little bit of discussion about what was going on, and I think hopefully we have that one resolved. I think I'm just delighted that we've gone as far as we have, and we'd like to see you pass all of them. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. We're not going to pass any of these bills out today. We're going to try and consolidate some of them and talk to make sure we've got everything right so that people have an opportunity to look over and sort of reflect upon the testimony today. So we'll schedule another work hearing, work session, probably next week sometime. At least we have these bills heard. We're in their timeline in the Senate to hear bills before the 23rd, so we have them heard. So they're on the table, and I appreciate your efforts and your time. And
that, we'll close the public hearing on all those six bills. And if there are no further questions, we'll adjourn the committee.
Well, I think that's